Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We'll be talking today about what a lot of people are going to be talking about this time of the year, and that's graduation, commencement. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, there will be something in the order of several million college and university graduates. You add that with all the high school graduations, there's a whole lot of graduation speaking going on. And one of the major responsibilities faced by any number of persons, famous, infamous, and perhaps lesser known, is to come up with what to say to graduates. Today, just in terms of the graduations on this campus, I presided over my 48th and my second just in the last week. And I've given two commencement addresses just in the last, 7 days. Added to all the other schools for whom I've done commencement, I've done well over 100 of them. And I know there are a lot of people also out there who do a lot of speaking at commencements. I'll tell you, it's a great privilege. But one of the great challenges is to say something. Now, what I want to ask you today is for fun. I just want you to imagine that you have the responsibility to be a commencement speaker. You know, you be it high school, college, university, you name it. I'd like to know what you would say to graduates. And there really is just as wide open a question as you could imagine here. I'd like to know what you would do if you were a commencement speaker. And I'll talk to you when we come back to this in just a moment about how I go through the process of trying to think that through. I think there's some really horrible models out there of commencement speeches. I'll tell you the truth about that. And we'll look at some of the shenanigans that have gone on in the name of commencement speaking. And, of course, this year there's already a great deal of controversy focused on a commencement speech, and that is the one that is scheduled to be given Sunday at the University of Notre Dame by President Barack Obama. So we'll be talking today about, number one, how all this came to be, and then we're going to talk about how you would approach this if you had the opportunity to be a commencement speaker. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want you to talk. I want to hear from you what you would say. I'll give you a little hint about what I said today in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, a look at other issues in the news, and of course, as always, the newspapers give us an assortment of things interesting, fascinating, repulsive, and sometimes illuminating. The New York Times health page, a page that I often do not see so closely, has a very interesting article out this week on stumbling blocks on the path of righteousness. Now, I looked at that. That's right down our territory. I thought, well, I better take a look at what this has to do with health. Now, get this. It turns out, and this is why, from a Christian worldview perspective, this article is really interesting. It turns out that most people believe they are more moral than everyone else. In other words, it turns out that most people are pretty attuned to self-righteousness. There is, now this is the language used by Benedict Carey, writing in the New York Times, there is a self-inflating bias when it comes to moral judgment. I like that. I think that works out well. When you think about some of what you see and observe and hear in the culture, a self-inflating bias is a pretty good way to put this. Moral indignation. The author here, Benedict Carey, is arguing that sometimes it is appropriate, but he's also arguing that there are people who use moral indignation about the behavior of others in order to make themselves feel better about their own behavior. Here's a very interesting paragraph. Just listen to this. You know it had to get to this. Quote, one practice that can potentially temper feelings of moral superiority is religion. All major faiths emphasize the value of being humble and the perils of hubris. Quote, in humility, count others as better than yourself, St. Paul advises in his letter to the Philippians. Now, on the other hand, for some people, religion appears to amplify the instinct to feel like a moral beacon. That is, again, very, very interesting. So here is one of the dilemmas from a Christian worldview perspective. You know, the ability to make moral judgment requires some kind of standard. And we face a world in which there are an increasingly few number of persons who believe in an objective moral standard. If you are a Christian, then by definition, if you really understand Christianity, you believe in an objective moral standard. Now, when you believe in an objective moral law, then when you look at situations, you come to understand that there is a right and a wrong that may not always be clear. I mean, you take some end-of-life issue, you can realize it can be hard to know exactly what to do in this circumstance. But in most circumstances, it's pretty clear to know what is right and what is wrong. Now, the only way to feel morally inferior in a situation like that, that is truly morally inferior, is to fall short and violate this code at every turn. Well, thankfully, most people don't do that. But I understand what's going on here. I think Benedict Carey, as much as he's probably coming from a very divergent worldview, I think he's onto something here, and that is that when we pattern ourselves in a way of thinking in which we make ourselves feel morally superior because, well, we don't do those things, we really fall into a situation in which we can experience this, quote, self-inflating bias. I like that. Now, I am fascinated by the fact that it says here that one practice that can potentially temper feelings of moral superiority is religion. Well, that's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because we do hope that believers in the Christian faith, the followers of Christ, do behave in a way that is morally superior to those who do not know the law of Christ, who do not have the indwelling Christ, who do not have the revelation of God speaking to us as the Holy Spirit confirms the Scripture in our hearts. We hope that produces someone who lives on a higher moral plane. I mean, without that, Christianity doesn't make a great deal of sense. We are not moralists. We do not believe that we are saved by moralism, but we do believe that the indwelling Christ should produce a life of increasing holiness and a demonstration of that holiness. But on the other hand, Christians are those who believe and know that we are all sinners. We're the people who understand Genesis 3, and one of the challenges for every Christian generation is to take Genesis 3 into full account. We're the people who can sometimes be disappointed, but when it comes to human behavior, we're the people who should be rarely shocked. I don't know, I just found that very, very interesting. I found it interesting at a number of levels, and I'm still scratching my head trying to figure out, why did this end up on the health section of the New York Times? I guess only they can answer that question. Here's another very interesting article. Time Magazine is out, and I've been waiting for something like this. So much of what's going on in terms of the discussion of the credit crisis in this country, the bankruptcies that are taking place, the foreclosures that are being threatened, all of the attention heretofore has basically been put on lenders, on finance companies and mortgage brokers and all the rest, suggesting that this is all their fault. When it comes to credit cards, now Barbara Kivat, writing at Time Magazine, comes back and says, here's the real problem with credit cards. It's not the issuers of the cards. It's the people who hold the cards. In other words, there are persons who have been given credit and who ought to be given credit, ought to be given some level of credit, but they have no idea how they're using credit. And so it's not that they have been irresponsibly given credit. It's that they're irresponsibly using credit. The problem with the credit card industry isn't just the credit card companies, says Barbara Kivat. It's you, too. This week, the Senate takes up a bill that would seriously clamp down on some of the industry's most unsavory practices. Well, that's right now a matter of legislative interest. But it goes on. It says there are piles of evidence that people are bad decision makers when it comes to how they use credit cards. Here's a fascinating thing that I discovered in looking at this story. Do you realize that most people who sign credit card contracts never even claim to have read them? I don't know about you, but I find that a bit disturbing. You would think that someone entering into something like a credit agreement, in which potentially thousands and thousands of dollars could be at stake, that they would at least read the agreement. But the fact is, human nature being what it is, you can come up with whatever legislation you want. But if the problem is the user of the cards, legislation that really addresses itself to the issuers of the cards is not going to solve the problem. Los Angeles Times is out with an interesting article about how online gambling as an industry is really doing its very best in Congress to get it legalized on the Internet. I'm reading here from a story by Ben Meyerson of the Los Angeles Times. He says, arguing that it is here to stay and can be regulated. Now, get this, and taxed. You see, this is the argument in which gambling always gets in the door. It's not just that, well, somebody's going to do it. It's not just that we ought to regulate it. You watch how government treats this. It's, well, if we can regulate it, we can tax it. So you have the lottery sold on the idea that it's going to provide all these funds for schools. And now you've got Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, head of the House Financial Services Committee, who is leading the fight for online gamblers. And, of course, they're coming back and saying, look, you can get tax money here. The poker players and other online gamblers have gotten organized, Barney Frank said, adding they supported the legislation as a matter of personal freedom. Now, that's really, really interesting. personal freedom. This gets tied right back to the credit card issue. You know, if you're wondering why people gamble, I mean, you know the odds. You know how bad the odds are. You know that most people lose everything when they gamble. Otherwise, by the way, gambling wouldn't work. Well, evidently, the people doing that are the same people that don't read the credit card contracts they sign and then go out and misuse their credit cards. Then again, that gets back to the Christian worldview, doesn't it? Because we're the people who understand that human beings, because of sin, are capable of infinite self-deception. All kinds of foolishness. Lots to ponder today as we come to the end of the week on the Albert Miller Program, but let's put the question right before us all. What would you say if you had the opportunity to be a commencement speaker? Give me a call, 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with your calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. We're talking today about commencement speeches. I've given my second in the last 7 days today. It was a great privilege to speak to the graduates of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary today, as a week ago, the graduates of Boyce College. My commencement address was entitled The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory. I was speaking to young ministers going out into the world, and a record number of them, by the way, one of the largest graduating classes in the history of theological education. One of the things that has surprised me as president of this institution is how emotional commencement is. We get to know these students, love these students, and then they cross that platform and receive their diploma, and we may never see them again. We get to know them. We get to know, in many cases, their wives, their spouses, their children. We see them married, and then we see them off. And it's a great thing for the kingdom of God. Sometimes a hard thing for an institution. I spoke on the kingdom, the power, and the glory as I was coming to the end of the Lord's Prayer, making the point to these graduates that the only reason that our ministry is secure is because of Christ and the fact that he is faithful to his promises. And when we say, thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, we are affirming that he whom we serve is the one who is the sovereign of the world. And one of the things I said to these graduates is, you're incompetent. You know, and that may sound like an insult, but it starts at the top. There is no competency in us to be ministers of the gospel of Christ. There is no human flesh that is competent for that. There's no bar association or you know, professional society that can accredit that. But as the Apostle Paul says, in the Corinthian correspondence, he says, God chooses the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chooses the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians, we are earthen vessels. We are clay vessels. We are chosen in order that our inadequacy would point to the adequacy of Christ. I had fun talking about this, and in particular, looking to that last phrase of the Lord's Prayer as a way of giving encouragement to these graduates. I spoke to Boyce College from Colossians chapter 1 last week, just reminding them of what it means for Christ to put all things under his feet and for us to have the privilege of serving the church for whom Christ died. You start looking at that, well, I was speaking to a very clearly Christian context. I've also given a couple of commencement addresses with a less explicitly Christian context. I've spoken to high school graduations, college and university graduations. And by the way, some of those are really interesting because I spoke at one university graduation where they said, you can say anything you want to say. We're looking forward to hearing everything you want to say. You've got 11 minutes. And they meant it, too, by the way. And I made it, which is perhaps even more amazing. But then I've spoken at graduate school graduations and seminary graduations. And I'll tell you, it really is interesting, but it's also a tremendous challenge because here you've got this captive audience. And you got all the graduates arrayed before you. It's this big formal occasion. You know, we all of a sudden turn back to the medieval era when we do graduation. We dress up in garb, those of us in faculty and those graduates. We wear clothes that, you know, people haven't worn since the 15th century, but we feel pretty good wearing it. It's a little unusual. By the way, it was very hot today. We had an outdoor graduation. Just a reminder of what life is like without air conditioning. But it was a phenomenal day, a beautiful day, a spectacular day. There will be some other famous commencement speeches coming up just in the course of the next several days. I think you probably are already aware of the controversy about President Barack Obama's commencement address to be given on Sunday at the University of Notre Dame. And the big controversy there, well, it's pretty obvious. Here you have the most famous Catholic institution in America, inviting the president of the United States, and this particular president being one who is, by any measure, the most pro-choice, pro-abortion president in the nation's history. This has led even the resident bishop there in northern Indiana to say he's going to boycott. And now the list of boycotting bishops is becoming huge. The University of Notre Dame may be facing one of the largest controversies of its history. And Marianne Glendon, who's the United States ambassador to the Vatican, was to receive the highest award given by the University of Notre Dame at that ceremony, and she is withdrawn as a matter of conscience. I guarantee you there will be a lot of media attention to what goes on there in South Bend, Indiana, on Sunday. There have been a lot of media attention to commencement addresses in the past. Some of you may remember that it was in 1947 at Harvard University that Secretary of State George Marshall suggested a plan whereby the United States would reach out to Europe in a way to save the starving peoples at the end of World War II. That's where he launched what became known as the Marshall Plan. So that was a commencement address that changed history. There are others that have hardly done that. David Foster Wallace, the author at Kenyon College in the year 2005, explored, and this is Time Magazine reporting, some very unusual themes. Newsweek, by the way, points out that he asked these students to consider life, death, and how to think in a speech that was equally funny and true. By the way, shortly after that, he committed suicide. That puts a different twist on what he asked those graduates to think about. There are some who take it as a matter of an opportunity for humor. There are others who try to make it extremely literary. There are some who make it entirely short. I heard of one commencement address not long ago where the commencement speaker got up and said, "You have heard it said that you should seize the day. I just say, don't." Well, that was a rather frivolous waste of time, even though it may be memorable. I'll tell you another memorable one. You may remember that it was Winston Churchill at a commencement address in which he was speaking at the Harrow School, from which he was a graduate. It's basically a high school, a prep school there in Great Britain. He said, "Never give in, never give in, never, 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 in nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense, never yield to force, never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy," end quote. That express, "never give in," given in 1941 to his own school, there, even in the midst there of World War II, became a great inspirational message. And by the way, it's usually misquoted. Americans love to say never give up. British people wouldn't know what you're talking about when you say never give up. Their expression is never give in. But nonetheless, we certainly get the point. I want to know, what would you say if you were going to deliver a commencement address? What would you say? And let's just assume right now that you have the responsibility, that some schools invited you to deliver a commencement address. Let's just say perhaps you just heard one, and you'd like to have had the opportunity to say something other than what you heard. Perhaps you, as a graduate of high school or college or some other context, you came expecting to hear something, and you heard basically nothing. What would you say to graduates? This is really important because what we have here is a meaning of life speech. That's what commencement is really about. If a commencement speech is good, it's a meaning of life speech. And this is what, well, I'll admit, I've got an agenda in asking this question today, so I'm going to go ahead and hit my own tripwire. Here's my subversive plot for this program. I want to prove, by means of this discussion, that if you do not operate out of something like a Christian worldview, a very clear Christian worldview, then meaning of life speeches are the hardest speeches to give, because you're not sure what the meaning of life is. You see, that's the bottom life. If you don't have a clear understanding about the meaning of life, it's really tough to try to get up in front of a bunch of people and say, well, what are you going to say? Be happy? You know, give life your best? Are you going to say, go make a lot of money? Go make a name for yourself? Or will you do what some people do and say, go serve humanity? Well, you know, the problem is humanity is pretty difficult to serve. A lot of humanity doesn't want to be served. A lot of humanity won't thank you when they have been served. My argument is, if you don't come from a pretty robust worldview, and I'm going to speak specifically of the Christian worldview, then I'd just like to know, what are you going to do when you get up? You know, be nice? Well, I'm all for people being nice, but if you're going to give a meaning of life speech, hopefully you got some meaning to put into life. If you had the opportunity to be a commencement speaker, what would you say? Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
It was former Senator Bob Dole who made the comment that I think I probably remember more than anything else when it comes to commencement speeches. He was offering some advice. He's given several himself. He was offering advice. He said, just remember this if you're going to give a commencement speech. He said, your role in this process is pretty much like that of a corpse at the funeral. They can't have the thing without you, but they don't expect you to say much. And, you know, he had a way of making with a sense of humor a point. But, you know, if I'm going to give a speech, I'm going to try to say something. I'm not there to say nothing. They can invite someone else to say nothing. If you invite me, I'm going to do my very best to say something. By the way, something gets you in trouble more than nothing. I can give you that from world experience. The phone call for the discussion is 877-893-8255. I'd love to hear from you and to hear what you would do if you had the opportunity to give a commencement address. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Stephen's listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, if I was to give a speech as valedictorian, what I would do is I would just share the gospel with my fellow classmates. I'm about to graduate high school, and that's definitely what I would do.
Hey, Stephen, it's great to hear from you. So when do you graduate?
I graduate June 5th.
Kind of looking forward to it?
Yeah, definitely looking forward to get out of high school.
All right, so what's next?
I'm going to go to Boyce, hopefully, Boyce College, but in the spring semester.
All right, Stephen, I got to tell you, I think that is an outstanding choice. And as the president of Boyce College, I got to tell you just made my day. And you made my day with the call, too. I really appreciate that. Stephen, let me just add, because I think a lot of people will be a little bit surprised to know that in most valedictorian and salutatorian speeches, you can say pretty much whatever you want to say operating from your worldview. And see, here's where Christians often think, well, you can't share the gospel in a situation like that. But here's the constitutional law on the issue, so far as I understand it. And you may need to check where you are, but you really need to check carefully. Don't let people intimidate you just by telling you something that isn't so. The reality is that if people can get up and share their humanistic viewpoint, if they can get up and share their Buddhist worldview, if they can get up and share their secular worldview, then you're just as free to get up and share your Christian testimony to the gospel. And this is something that's been adjudicated over and over and over again. But I really appreciate Stephen. And, Stephen is saying that if he had the opportunity, then he would say something. And the something he would say is the gospel. And, woe unto any of us if we have an opportunity to speak and we fail to give a witness to Christ. That would be a great tragedy. Stephen, thanks so much for your call, and congratulations on your graduation. I'll certainly look forward to seeing you. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Beth's on the line. Go ahead, Beth.
Well, amen, Stephen. That's a hard act to follow. What I would say is I'm sitting out here looking at all of you, and you've obviously, you're able to set goals and achieve them. You're obviously bright. You're pretty creative. You have been asked your whole life what you want to do with your life and where you want to go to school and what you want to major in. But the key to everything, to happiness, to gratification, to fulfillment, is to ask yourself one question, not what you would do with your life, but what God would do with your life.
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting point, Beth. And it gets to the severe dichotomy between the Christian and secular worldviews. And when you bring the word God into this, speaking as a Christian, well, everything becomes clarified. Instantly, you have the two very different worldviews. The late James Orr, theologian of the last century, in the late 19th century, made the point. He said, between the Christian worldview and the secular worldview, there is a deep and radical antagonism. And I'll never forget that phrase, a deep and radical antagonism, which is to say that if your worldview begins with God, you're going to end up in a very different understanding of just about everything than if your worldview begins with you. And Beth said the most important thing is not what you would do with your life, but what God would do with your life. And that's just a transformative change in the whole subject from you to God. And that's exactly what the Apostle Paul is talking about, for instance, in the book of Romans, chapter 12, where he says that we should be living sacrifices and that we should submit ourselves as a living sacrifice to God, holy and acceptable. And then he goes on and says that we are not to be conformed to this world, but we are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds so that we might prove what is the will of God, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. So there's the purpose of life. We are to prove the will of God. We are to demonstrate in our lives the will of God. That changes everything. All right. We have heard from Beth, and we have heard from Stephen. I'd love to hear from you. What would you say if you just found yourself as a commencement speaker? High school? For that matter, kindergarten? College, university, graduate school? Let me know what you'd say. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Right now, I can almost guarantee you somewhere in America, there are people lining up, especially high school graduations. I bet you there are hundreds of them tonight. An awful lot of words are going to be expressed. I wonder how many of them will bear any weight. The phone number, 877-893-8255. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
All right, here's your assignment. You are the commencement speaker. You name the school, you name the occasion, you name the context. You're going to have to decide what to say. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'd love to know what you would say if you had the opportunity to be a commencement speaker. Let's go to Kearney, Nebraska. Marcia's on the line. Go ahead, Marcia.
Oh, hello. This is Marcia, and I just think it's really important for graduates to know that that opportunity might be disguised. It might come in, you know, in a way that you're not expecting, in a, you know, a job opportunity, where you, but you have to work hard at it. Also, that it's important to savor simple things in life, to make the most of your education. But I think primarily, I would just like them to know that love has a cost, and are you prepared to pay it?
Marcia, I appreciate your call, and I'll tell you, if I think along those terms that you're talking, which have a great deal of suggestive power to them, I'll tell you, I think I would go back and say, if I was speaking especially to a high school class or to a college class, you know, friendship is more valuable than you may think it is. And the further you get in life, you're going to discover that a core of friends around you who are really committed to the same things, who believe the same things, that's going to be really, really important. And I want to say that to Christians. I think there are far too many Christians, Christian men in particular, even more so than Christian women, but especially Christian men. There are a lot of men who simply don't have a core of friends around them who share the same values, who share the same worldview, who share the same commitments. And there's a real vulnerability there. There's a real power in a core of friends together. Thanks for your call, Marcia. We appreciate that. What would you say if you had the opportunity to be a commencement speaker? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Sean's on the line. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, Albert. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
Good. So I just wanted to call in and just a brief story about what happened at my sister's high school graduation a few years back. She goes to a public school, 2,000 students, so about 500 graduating students. And the valedictorian got up to speak and was given a great speech, very calm. You know, a lot of those seniors can be pretty nervous, but she was given an excellent speech. And then she said that the main thing she wanted to focus on was the fact that her whole life had changed when she came to know Jesus Christ in ninth grade. And I'll tell you, when she said that, again, it's a public high school, 2,000 students, and all the administrators, you could see them look over, and the hush went over the whole crowd. And I just thought, what an impact just that statement had. And she paused after she said it and really let it sink in. And I just thought, man, what a testimony to her courage in Jesus and how obviously her life had changed in ninth grade and how it affected her through those 4 years and allowed her to be the valedictorian. So it's very encouraging. I just heard that other high school student call in and say he would say that. So there are other people with the courage to do that.
Yeah, Sean, and, you know, it does take courage. That's the amazing thing. And that's why some of these kids, and I don't say that disparagingly, condescendingly, some of these teenagers and young adults who will show that kind of courage, that they put their elders to shame. Because there are an awful lot of Christians who even in the workplace, never speak up. No one even knows they're a Christian. Even in the neighborhood, no one knows they're a Christian. And here out of the blue, you got a 17- or 18-year-old who stands up and says, my life was transformed in the ninth grade when I came to know the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior. You know, you just got to stand back and say, all right, we got some adrenaline here. for the cause of the gospel. There's something just beautiful about that. Sean, thanks for sharing that story from Baltimore, Maryland. We've received word of a listener writing in by Twitter saying God can do much with the life given to him, but our opportunity to serve is over in a blink. Don't waste it. You know, boy, I got to tell you, that's true. I look back at my 17-year-old self graduating from high school, and I thought I was so old. Now I look back and I think, my heavens, I was so young, and yet you blink twice and you're here. And that is, I know when you're young, that sounds absolutely ridiculous. So let me just tell you, it's nonetheless true. It may sound ridiculous, but it's true. And we just don't have a clue how long the Lord's going to give us to live anyway. We tend when we're young to presume that we'll have a long life. And thanks to, you know, the gift of modern medicine and many other things, on average, a lot of people will live a good number of years. But the reality is we just don't know and we cannot presume. What would you say if you had the opportunity to be a commencement speaker? Would you speak of meaning of life? Would you speak of just something pragmatic and prudential? You know, there are all these commencement speakers. A lot of schools, by the way, especially colleges and universities, are trying to make a statement by their commencement speaker invitations. They're trying to snag a big speaker in order to say something. Of course, if you get the President of the United States, you got some prestige coming in terms of your commencement speaker. You get a Secretary of State, you get the Vice President, any number of persons who by office, the Governor of your state, United States Senator. If you're in one of those roles, you can pretty much count on getting more invitations than you can accept graduation time. But there are others, too, and I'll tell you, the ones that really frustrate me are the colleges and universities, some of them quite prestigious, some of them very much committed to an ideal of scholarship who will invite Hollywood types to give commencement speeches. And I find this just absolutely perplexing. I will tell you that I personally have heard some horrible addresses given by people who were famous, but obviously not up to this particular task. Alex, writing in by Twitter, said we should give emphasis to devotion to Christ because knowledge is only as good as it produces worship and obedience. You know, that's another thing. You know, it's just speaking at commencement at say, one of the great research universities of this country. Say you had the opportunity to be the commencement speaker at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, MIT, Caltech. You look at all that learning, all that investment in scholarship, all that training, all that theory, all of that that has come down to the degrees and diplomas to be awarded, and you look at it and you think, you know, it's all so little in the grand scheme of eternity. It looks so big here. But knowledge that is detached from the Christian worldview is knowledge that eventually, in its autonomy, becomes toxic. It is not health, but unhealth to which it leads. And it is not wisdom, but foolishness. But it sure looks wise. Very, very interesting. You know, when you are a commencement speaker, one of the big issues you have to address is the fact that if you look out in most of the graduation audiences, you're going to see people young and old and in between. And you really have to speak very clearly to the graduates, knowing that there are those who will overhear. But my advice is, if you're going to give a commencement speech, speak to the graduates. Let others overhear, but don't speak over the graduates to the audience. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. Thanks for listening to the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. As we said, some commencement speeches have changed history. That was the case when George Marshall spoke at Harvard University and launched what became the Marshall Plan, that speech given in 1947. I'll tell you another one that came, just about 30 years after that. Alexander Solzhenitsyn gave the commencement address at Harvard University in 1978. The title of that address was A World Split Apart. And by the way, what Solzhenitsyn split apart was the faculty of Harvard University. In its opinion, because this was a man who got up, he had defied Stalin, he had defied Khrushchev, he had defied Brezhnev, he had been the one who had been persecuted in the gulag system in the Soviet Union. He didn't fear the faculty of Harvard. He got up in commencement in 1978 at Harvard University, and he spoke about a world split apart, and in particular he talked about the decadence of the West, the weakness of the West, the lack of will in the West to defend the very freedoms upon which it had been established. When he got to the end of that address, he said this. He says, as long as we wake up every morning under a peaceful sun, we have to lead an everyday life. There is a disaster, however, which has already been underway for some time. I'm referring to the calamity of a despiritualized and irreligious humanistic consciousness, end quote. Well, can you imagine the courage of that? Here you had Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who won the Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize, as a matter of fact, who was here to deliver this severe judgment against the very thing that, in the main, the faculty at Harvard University represented. He went on and he said, there was a disaster, again, that's been going for some time, the calamity of a despiritualized and irreligious humanistic consciousness. He said this, defining his terms, he said, to such consciousness, man is the touchstone in judging and evaluating everything on earth. In other words, it's a true humanism. At the center of all questions of meaning is nothing more than the human being. He went on to say, imperfect man who is never free of pride, self-interest, envy, vanity, and dozens of other defects. We are now experiencing the consequences of mistakes which had not been noticed at the beginning of the journey. On the way from the Renaissance to our days, we have enriched our experience, but we have lost the concept of a supreme, complete entity. That's very interesting. Supreme, complete entity. You can spell that with just three letters, God, which used to restrain our passions and our irresponsibility. We have placed too much hope in political and social reforms, only to find that we are being deprived of our most precious possession, our spiritual life. In the East, he meant that in the Soviet Union primarily, it is destroyed by the dealings and machinations of the ruling party. In the West, commercial interests tend to suffocate it. This is the real crisis. The split in the world is less terrible than the similarity of the disease plaguing its main sections. In other words, we are in big trouble, he said in 1978. A prophetic word. Given this, when he had the opportunity to speak, he said something. And the fact that it's still remembered and talked about now kind of says it all. Back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.